This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Silkworm. Written by Robert Galbraith. Read by Robert Glenister. To Jenkins, without whom he knows the rest. Blood and vengeance the scene, death the story. A sword imbrued with blood, the pen that writes. And the poet, a terrible, buskined, tragical fellow, with a wreath about his head of burning match instead of bays. The noble Spanish soldier, Thomas Dekker. Chapter 1. Question. What dost thou feed on? Answer. Broken sleep. Thomas Dekker, the noble Spanish soldier.
Someone bloody famous, said the hoarse voice on the end of the line. Better have died, Strike.
The large, unshaven man tramping through the darkness of pre-dawn, with his telephone clamped to his ear, grinned.
It's in that ballpark.
It's 6 o'clock in the fucking morning.
It's 1:30, but if you want what I've got, you'll need to come and get it, said Cormoran Strike. I'm not far away from your place. There's a...
How do you know where I live?
Demanded the voice.
You told me,
said Strike, stifling a yawn.
You're selling your flat.
Oh,
said the other, mollified.
Good memory.
There's a 24-hour calf.
Fuck that. Come into the office later.
Culpepper, I've got another client this morning. He pays better than you do, and I've been up all night. You need this now if you're going to use it.
A groan. Strike could hear the rustling of sheets.
It had better be shit hot.
Smithfield Cafe on Long Lane, said Strike, and rang off.
The slight unevenness in his gait became more pronounced as he walked down the slope towards Smithfield Market, monolithic in the winter darkness, a vast rectangular Victorian temple to meet, where from 4 every weekday morning, animal flesh was unloaded, as it had been for centuries past, cut, parcelled, and sold to butchers and restaurants across London. Strike could hear the voices through the gloom, shouted instructions, and the growl and beep of reversing lorries unloading the carcasses. As he entered Long Lane, he became merely one among many heavily muffled men, moving purposefully about their Monday morning business. A huddle of couriers in fluorescent jackets, cupped mugs of tea in their gloved hands, beneath a stone griffin, standing sentinel on the corner of the market building. Across the road, glowing like an open fireplace against the surrounding darkness, was the Smithfield Cafe, open 24 hours a day, a cupboard-sized cachet of warmth and greasy food. The cafe had no bathroom, but an arrangement with the bookies a few doors along. Ladbrokes would not open for another 3 hours. So Strike made a detour down a side alley, and in a dark doorway, relieved himself of a bladder bulging with weak coffee drunk in the course of a night's work. Exhausted and hungry, he turned at last with the pleasure that only a man who has pushed himself past his physical limits can ever experience, into the fat-laden atmosphere of frying eggs and bacon. 2 men in fleeces and waterproofs had just vacated a table. Strike maneuvered his bulk into the small place and sank, with a grunt of satisfaction, onto the hard wood and steel chair. Almost before he asked, the Italian owner placed tea in front of him in a tall white mug, which came with triangles of white buttered bread. Within 5 minutes, a full English breakfast lay before him on a large oval plate. Strike blended well with the strong men banging their way in and out of the cafe. He was large and dark, with dense short curly hair that had receded a little from the high dome forehead that topped a boxer's broad nose and thick surly brows. His jaw was grimy with stubble, and bruised coloured shadows enlarged his dark eyes. He ate, gazing dreamily at the market building opposite. The nearest arched entrance, numbered 2, was taking substance as the darkness thinned. A stern stone face, ancient and bearded, stared back at him from over the doorway. Had there ever been a god of carcasses? He had just started on his sausages when Dominic Culpepper arrived. The journalist was almost as tall as Strike, but thin, with a choirboy's complexion. A strange asymmetry, as though somebody had given his face a counterclockwise twist, stopped him being girlishly handsome. "This better be good," Culpepper said as he sat down, pulled off his gloves, and glanced almost suspiciously around the cafe.
"Want some food?"
asked Strike, through a mouthful of sausage.
"No,"
said Culpepper.
"Rather wait till you can get a croissant?"
asked Strike, grinning.
"Fuck off, Strike."
It was almost pathetically easy to wind up the ex-public schoolboy, who ordered tea with an air of defiance, calling the indifferent waiter, as Strike noted with amusement, "Mate." "Well?" demanded Culpepper, with a hot mug in his long, pale hands. Strike, fished in his overcoat pocket, brought out an envelope and slid it across the table. Culpepper pulled out the contents and began to read.
"Fucking hell," he said quietly after a while.
He shuffled feverishly through the bits of paper, some of which were covered in Strike's own writing.
"Where the hell did you get this?"
Strike, whose mouth was full of sausage, jabbed a finger at one of the bits of paper, on which an office address was scribbled.
"Is very fucked off PA," he said, when he had finally swallowed. "He's been shagging her, as well as the two you know about. She's only just realized she's not going to be the next Lady Parker."
"How the hell did you find that out?" asked Culpepper, staring up at Strike, over the papers trembling in his excited hands.
"Detective work," said Strike thickly, through another bit of sausage. "Didn't your lot used to do this before you started outsourcing to the likes of me? But she's got to think about her future employment prospects, Culpepper, so she doesn't want to appear in the story."
"All right,"
Culpepper snorted. "She should have thought about that before she nicked." With a deft movement, Strike tweaked the papers out of the journalist's fingers.
"She didn't nick 'em. He got her to print this lot off for him this afternoon. The only thing she's done wrong is show it to me. But if you're going to splash her private life all over the papers, Culpepper, I'll take 'em back."
"Piss off,"
said Culpepper, making a grab for the evidence of wholesale tax evasion clutched in Strike's hairy hand.
"All right, we'll leave her out of it. But he'll know where we got it. He's not a complete tit."
"What's he going to do? Drag her into court where she can spill the beans about every dodgy thing she's witnessed over the last 5 years?"
"Yeah, all right," sighed Culpepper, after a moment's reflection. "Give him back. I'll leave her out of the story, but I'll need to speak to her, won't I? Check she's kosher."
"Those are kosher. You don't need to speak to her," said Strike firmly.
The shaking, besotted, bitterly betrayed woman whom he had just left would not be safe left alone with Culpepper. In her savage desire for retribution against a man who had promised her marriage and children, she would damage herself and her prospects beyond repair. It had not taken Strike long to gain her trust. She was nearly 42. She had thought that she was going to have Lord Parker's children. Now a kind of bloodlust had her in its grip. Strike had sat with her for several hours, listening to the story of her infatuation, watching her pace her sitting room in tears, rock backwards and forwards on her sofa, knuckles to her forehead. Finally, she had agreed to this. A betrayal that represented the funeral of all her hopes.
"You're going to leave her out of it," said Strike,
holding the papers firmly in a fist that was nearly twice the size of Culpepper's.
"Right? This is still a fucking massive story without her."
After a moment's hesitation, and with a grimace, Culpepper caved in.
"Yeah, all right. Give me them."
The journalist shoved the statements into an inside pocket and gulped his tea, and his momentary disgruntlement at Strike seemed to fade in the glorious prospect of dismantling the reputation of a British peer.
"Lord Parker of Pennywell," he said happily under his breath, "you are well and truly screwed, mate."
"I take it your proprietor'll get this?" Strike asked,
as the bill landed between them.
Yeah, yeah.
Culpepper threw a £10 note down onto the table, and the two men left the cafe together. Strike lit up a cigarette as soon as the door had swung closed behind them.
How did you get her to talk?
Culpepper asked, as they set off together through the cold, past the motorbikes and lorries still arriving at and departing the market.
I listened, said Strike.
Culpepper shot him a sideways glance.
All the other private dicks I use spend their time hacking phone messages.
Illegal, said Strike, blowing smoke into the thinning darkness.
So how?
You protect your sources, and I'll protect mine.
They walked 50 yards in silence, Strike's limp more marked with every step.
This is going to be massive. Massive, said Culpepper gleefully. That hypocritical old shit's been bleating on about corporate greed, and he's had 20 mil stashed in the Cayman Islands.
Glad to give satisfaction, said Strike. I'll email you my invoice.
Culpepper threw him another sideways look. See Tom Jones's son in the paper last week? He asked.
Tom Jones?
Welsh singer, said Culpepper.
Oh, him, said Strike, without enthusiasm. I knew a Tom Jones in the army.
Did you see the story?
Nope.
Nice long interview he gave. He says he's never met his father, never had a word from him. I bet he got more than your bill is going to be.
You haven't seen my invoice yet, said Strike.
Just saying, one nice little interview and you could take a few nights off from interviewing secretaries.
You're going to have to stop suggesting this, said Strike, or I'm going to have to stop working for you, Culpepper.
Course, said Culpepper. I could run the story anyway. Rockstar's estranged son is a war hero, never knew his father, working as a private.
Instructing people to hack phones is illegal as well, I've heard.
At the top of Long Lane, they slowed and turned to face each other. Culpepper's laugh was uneasy.
I'll wait for your invoice, then.
Suits me.
They set off in different directions, Strike heading towards the tube station.
Strike!
Culpepper's voice echoed through the darkness behind him.
Did you fuck her? Looking forward to reading it, Culpepper, Strike shouted wearily, without turning his head.
He limped into the shadowy entrance of the station and was lost to Culpepper's sight. Chapter 2 How long must we fight? For I cannot stay, nor will not stay. I have business. Francis Beaumont and Philip Massinger, the little French lawyer. The tube was filling up already. Monday morning faces, sagging, gaunt, braced, resigned. Strike found a seat opposite a puffy-eyed young blonde whose head kept sinking sideways into sleep. Again and again she jerked herself back upright, scanning the blurred signs of the stations frantically in case she had missed her stop. The train rattled and clattered, speeding Strike back towards the meagre 2.5 rooms under a poorly insulated roof that he called home. In the depths of his tiredness, surrounded by these blank, sheep-like visages, he found himself pondering the accidents that had brought all of them into being. Every birth was, viewed properly, mere chance. With 100 million sperm swimming blindly through the darkness, the odds against a person becoming themselves were staggering. How many of this tubeful had been planned, he wondered, light-headed with tiredness? And how many, like him, were accidents? There had been a little girl in his primary school class who had a port wine stain across her face, and Strike had always felt a secret kinship with her, because both of them had carried something indelibly different with them since birth. Something that was not their fault. They couldn't see it, but everybody else could, and had the bad manners to keep mentioning it. The occasional fascination of total strangers, which at 5 years old he had thought had something to do with his own uniqueness, he eventually realized was because they saw him as no more than a famous singer's zygote, the incidental evidence of a celebrity's unfaithful fumble. Strike had only met his biological father twice. It had taken a DNA test to make Johnny Rokeby accept paternity. Dominic Culpepper was a walking distillation of the prurience and presumptions that Strike met on the very rare occasions these days that anybody connected the surly-looking ex-soldier with the aging rock star. Their thoughts leapt at once to trust funds and handsome handouts, to private flights and VIP lounges, to multimillionaires' largesse on tap. Agog at the modesty of Strike's existence and the punishing hours he worked, they asked themselves, what must Strike have done to alienate his father? Was he faking penury to wheedle more money out of Rokeby? What had he done with the millions his mother had surely squeezed out of her rich paramour? And at such times, Strike would think nostalgically of the army, of the anonymity of a career in which your background and your parentage counted for almost nothing beside your ability to do the job. Back in the Special Investigation Branch, the most personal question he had faced on introduction was a request to repeat the odd pair of names with which his extravagantly unconventional mother had saddled him. Traffic was already rolling busily along Charing Cross Road by the time Strike emerged from the tube. The November dawn was breaking now, grey and half-hearted, full of lingering shadows. He turned into Denmark Street feeling drained and sore, looking forward to the short sleep he might be able to squeeze in before his next client arrived at 9:30. With a wave at the girl in the guitar shop, with whom he often took cigarette breaks in the street, Strike let himself in through the black outer door beside the 12-bar cafe and began to climb the metal staircase that curled around the broken birdcage lift inside. Up past the graphic designer on the first floor, past his own office with its engraved glass door on the second, up to the third and smallest landing, where his home now lay. The previous occupant, manager of the bar downstairs, had moved on to more salubrious quarters, and Strike, who had been sleeping in his office for a few months, had leapt at the chance to rent the place, grateful for such an easy solution to the problem of his homelessness. The space under the eaves was small by any standards, and especially for a man of 6'3". He scarcely had room to turn around in the shower. Kitchen and living room were uneasily combined, and the bedroom was almost entirely filled by the double bed. Some of Strike's possessions remained boxed up on the landing, in spite of the landlord's injunction against this. His small windows looked out across rooftops, with Denmark Street far below. The constant throb of the bass from the bar below was muffled to the point that Strike's own music often obliterated it. Strike's innate orderliness was manifest throughout. The bed was made, the crockery clean, everything in its place. He needed a shave and shower, but that could wait. After hanging up his overcoat, he set his alarm for 9:20 and stretched out on the bed fully clothed. He fell asleep within seconds, and within a few more, or so it seemed, he was awake again. Somebody was knocking on his door.
"I'm sorry, Cormoran. I'm really sorry."
His assistant, a tall young woman with long strawberry blonde hair, looked apologetic as he opened the door. But at the sight of him, her expression became appalled.
"Are you all right?"
"Was asleep. Been wake all night. Two nights."
"I'm really sorry," Robin repeated. "But it's 9:40, and William Baker's here and getting..."
"Shit," mumbled Strike. "Can't have set the alarm right. Give me 5 minutes.
"That's not all," said Robin. "There's a woman here. She hasn't got an appointment. I've told her you haven't got room for another client, but she's refusing to leave."
Strike yawned, rubbing his eyes.
5 minutes. Make them tea or something."
6 minutes later, in a clean shirt, smelling of toothpaste and deodorant but still unshaven, Strike entered the outer office where Robin was sitting at her computer.
"Well, better late than never," said William Baker with a rigid smile. "Lucky you've got such a good-looking secretary, or I might have got bored and left."
Strike saw Robin flush angrily as she turned away, ostensibly organizing the post. There had been something inherently offensive in the way that Baker had said, "Secretary." Immaculate in his pinstripe suit, the company director was employing Strike to investigate two of his fellow board members.
"Morning, William," said Strike.
"No apology,"
murmured Baker, his eyes on the ceiling.
"Hello, who are you?"
Strike asked, ignoring him and addressing instead the slight, middle-aged woman in an old brown overcoat who was perched on the sofa.
"Leonora Quine,"
she replied, in what sounded, to Strike's practiced ear, like a West Country accent.
"I've got a very busy morning ahead, Strike,"
said Baker. He walked without invitation into the inner office. When Strike did not follow, he lost a little of his suavity.
"I doubt you got away with shoddy timekeeping in the army, Mr. Strike. Come along, please."
Strike did not seem to hear him.
"What exactly is it you were wanting me to do for you, Mrs. Quine?"
he asked the shabby woman on the sofa.
"Well, it's my husband. Mr. Strike, I've got an appointment in just over an hour,"
said William Baker, more loudly.
"Your secretary said you didn't have no appointments, but I said I'd wait."
"Strike!"
barked William Baker, calling his dog to heel.
"Robin!"
snarled the exhausted Strike, losing his temper at last.
"Make up Mr. Baker's bill and give him the file. It's up to date."
"What?"
said William Baker, thrown. He re-emerged into the outer office.
"He's sacking you,"
said Leonora Quine, with satisfaction.
"You haven't finished the job,"
Baker told Strike.
"You said there was more—"
"Someone else can finish the job for you. Someone who doesn't mind tossers as clients."
The atmosphere in the office seemed to become petrified. Wooden-faced, Robin retrieved Baker's file from the outer cabinet and handed it to Strike.
"How dare!"
"There's a lot of good stuff in that file that'll stand up in court,"
said Strike, handing it to the director.
"Well worth the money."
"You haven't finished."
"He's finished with you,"
interjected Leonora Quine.
"Will you shut up, you stupid woman?"
William Baker began, then took a sudden step backwards as Strike took a half step forwards. Nobody said anything. The ex-serviceman seemed suddenly to be filling twice as much space as he had just seconds before.
"Take a seat in my office, Mrs. Quine," said Strike quietly.
She did as she was told.
"You think she'll be able to afford you?"
sneered a retreating William Baker, his hand now on the door handle.
"My fees are negotiable," said Strike.
"If I like the client."
He followed Leonora Quine into his office and closed the door behind him with a snap. Chapter 3. Left alone to bear up all these ills. Thomas Decker, the noble Spanish soldier.
"He's a right one, isn't he?"
commented Leonora Quine as she sat down in the chair facing Strike's desk.
"Yeah," agreed Strike, sinking heavily into the seat opposite her. "He is."
In spite of a barely crumpled pink and white complexion and the clear whites of her pale blue eyes, she looked around 50. Fine, limp, greying hair was held off her face by two plastic combs, and she was blinking at him through old-fashioned glasses with over-large plastic frames. Her coat, though clean, had surely been bought in the 80s. It had shoulder pads and large plastic buttons.
"So, you hear about your husband, Mrs. Quine?"
"Yeah,"
said Leonora.
"He's missing."
"How long's he been gone?"
asked Strike, reaching automatically for a notebook.
10 days,
said Leonora.
"Have you been to the police?"
"I don't need the police,"
she said impatiently, as though she was tired of explaining this to people.
"I called them once before, and everyone was angry at me because he was only with a friend. Owen just goes off sometimes. He's a writer,"
she said, as though this explained everything.
He's disappeared before.
He's emotional, she said, her expression glum. He's always going off on one, but it's been 10 days, and I know he's really upset, but I need him home now. There is Orlando, and I've got things to do, and there's...
Orlando, repeated Strike, his tired mind on the Florida resort.
He did not have time to go to America, and Leonora Quine, in her ancient coat, certainly did not look as though she could afford a ticket for him.
Our daughter, Orlando, said Leonora. She needs looking after. I've got a neighbor in to sit with her while I'm here.
There was a knock on the door, and Robin's bright gold head appeared.
Would you like coffee, Mr. Strike? You, Mrs. Quine?
When they had given Robin their orders and she had withdrawn, Leonora said,
It won't take you long because I think I know where he is. Only I can't get hold of the address and nobody'll take my calls. It's been 10 days, she repeated, and we need him home.
It seemed to Strike a great extravagance to resort to a private detective in this circumstance, especially as her appearance exhaled poverty.
If it's a simple question of making a phone call, he said gently, haven't you got a friend or a...
Edna can't do it, she said,
and he found himself disproportionately touched. Exhaustion sometimes laid him raw in this way, at her tacit admission that she had one friend in the world.
Owens told them not to say where he is. I need, she said simply, a man to do it. Force them to say.
Your husband's name's Owen, is it?
Yeah, she replied. Owen Quine. He wrote Hobart Sin.
Neither name nor title meant anything to Strike.
And you think you know where he is?
Yeah. We was at this party with a load of publishers and people. He didn't want to take me, but I says, I got a babysitter already, I'm coming. So, I hears Christian Fisher telling Owen about this place, this writer's retreat place. And afterwards I says to Owen, what was that place he was telling you about? And Owen says, I'm not telling you. That's the old bloody point, getting away from the wife and kids.
She almost invited Strike to join her husband in laughing at her, proud, as mothers sometimes pretend to be, of their child's insolence.
Who's Christian Fisher? Asked Strike,
forcing himself to concentrate.
Publisher, young, trendy bloke.
Have you tried phoning Fisher and asking him for the address of this retreat?
Yeah. I've called him every day for a week, and they said they'd take a message and they'd get back to me, but he hasn't. I think Owens told him not to say where he is, but you'll be able to get the address out of Fisher. I know you're good, she said. You solved that Lula Landry thing when the police never...
A mere 8 months previously, Strike had had but a single client, his business had been moribund, and his prospects desperate. Then he had proven, to the satisfaction of the Crown Prosecution Service, that a famous young woman had not committed suicide, but had been pushed to her death from a fourth-floor balcony. The ensuing publicity had brought a tide of business. He had been, for a few weeks, the best-known private detective in the metropolis. Johnny Rokeby had become a mere footnote to his story. Strike had become a name in his own right, albeit a name most people got wrong.
I interrupted you, he said, trying hard to hold on to the thread of his thoughts.
Did you?
Yeah,
said Strike, squinting at his own crabbed writing on the notebook.
You said, there's Orlando, I've got things to do, and there's...
Oh, yeah, she said. There's funny stuff happening since he left.
What kind of funny stuff?
Shit, said Leonora Quine matter-of-factly, through our letterbox.
Someone's put excrement through your letterbox, Strike said.
Yeah.
Since your husband disappeared.
Yeah, dog,
said Leonora. And it was a split second before Strike deduced that this applied to the excrement, not her husband.
3 or 4 times now at night. Nice thing to find in the morning, I don't think. And there was a woman come to the door and all, who was weird.
She paused, waiting for Strike to prompt her. She seemed to enjoy being questioned. Many lonely people, Strike knew,
found it pleasant to be the focus of somebody's undivided attention, and sought to prolong the novel experience.
When did this woman come to the door?
Last week it was, and she asks for Owen, and when I says he's not here, she says, "Tell him Angela died," and walks off.
And you didn't know her?
Never seen her before.
Do you know an Angela?
Nope, but he gets women fans going funny over him sometimes,
said Leonora, suddenly expansive.
Like, he had this woman once that wrote him letters and sent him photos of herself dressed up like one of his characters. Some of these women who write to him think he understands them or something because of his books. Silly, innit? She said. It's all made up.
Do fans usually know where your husband lives?
Nope, said Leonora. But she could have been a student or something. He teaches writing as well sometimes.
The door opened and Robin entered with a tray. After putting black coffee in front of Strike and a tea in front of Leonora Quine, she withdrew again, closing the door behind her.
Is that everything strange that's happened? Strike asked Leonora. The excrement through the door and this woman coming to the house?
And I think I've been followed. Tall, dark girl with round shoulders, said Leonora.
This is a different woman to the one...
Yeah. The one that come to the house was dumpy, long red hair. This one's dark and bent over-like.
You're sure she was following you?
Yeah, I think so. I've seen her behind me 2-3 times now. She isn't local. I've never seen her before, and I've lived in Ladbroke Grove 30-odd years.
Okay, said Strike slowly. You said your husband's upset. What happened to upset him?
He had a massive row with his agent.
What about, you know?
His book, his latest. Liz, that's his agent, tells him it's the best thing he's ever done, and then, like a day later, she takes him out to dinner and says it's unpublishable.
Why did she change her mind?
Ask her, said Leonora, showing anger for the first time. Of course he was upset after that, anyone would be. He's worked on that book for 2 years. He comes home in a right state and he goes into his study and he grabs it all.
Grabs what?
His book, the manuscript and his notes and everything, swearing his head off, and he shoves them in a bag and he goes off and I haven't seen him since.
Has he got a mobile? Have you tried calling him?
Yeah, and he's not picking up. He never does when he goes off like this. He chucked his phone out the car window once, she said, again with that faint note of pride at her husband's spirit.
Mrs. Quine, said Strike, whose altruism necessarily had its limits, whatever he had told William Baker, I'll be honest with you. I don't come cheap.
That's all right, said Leonora implacably. Liz'll pay.
Liz?
Liz. Elizabeth Tassel, Owen's agent. It's her fault he's gone away. She can take it out of her commission. He's her best client. She'll want him back, all right, once she realizes what she's done.
Strike did not set as much store by this assurance as Leonora herself seemed to. He added 3 sugars to the coffee and gulped it down, trying to think how best to proceed. He felt vaguely sorry for Leonora Quine, who seemed inured to her erratic husband's tantrums, who accepted the fact that nobody would deign to return her calls, who was sure that the only help she could expect must be paid for. Her slight eccentricity of manner aside, there was a truculent honesty about her. Nevertheless, he had been ruthless in taking on only profitable cases since his business had received its unexpected boost. Those few people who had come to him with hard luck stories, hoping that his own personal difficulties, reported and embellished in the press, would predispose him to helping them free of charge, had left disappointed. But Leonora Quine, who had drunk her tea quite as quickly as Strike had downed his coffee, was already on her feet, as though they had agreed terms and everything was settled.
"I better get going," she said. "I don't like leaving Orlando too long. She's missing her daddy. I've told her I'm getting a man to go find him."
Strike had recently helped several wealthy young women rid themselves of city husbands who had become much less attractive to them since the financial crash.
There was something appealing about restoring a husband to a wife for a change.
All right, he said, yawning as he pushed his notebook towards her. I'll need your contact details, Mrs. Coyne. A photograph of your husband will be handy, too.
She wrote her address and telephone number out for him, in a round, childish hand, but his request for a photo seemed to surprise her.
What do you need a picture for? He's at that writer's retreat. Just make Christian Fisher tell you where it is.
She was through the door before Strike, tired and sore, could emerge from behind his desk. He heard her say briskly to Robin,
"Ta for the tea."
Then the glass door onto the landing opened with a flash and closed with a gentle judder. And his new client had gone. Chapter 4. Well, 'tis a rare thing to have an ingenious friend. William Congreve, the Double Dealer. Strike dropped onto the sofa in the outer office. It was almost new, an essential expense as he had broken the second-hand one with which he had initially furnished the office. Covered in mock leather that he had thought smart in the showroom, it had made farting noises if you moved on it in the wrong way. His assistant, tall, curvaceous, with a clear, brilliant complexion and bright blue-grey eyes, scrutinized him over her coffee cup.
You look terrible.
Spent all night weaseling details of a peer of the realm, sexual irregularities and financial malfeasance out of a hysterical woman, said Strike, on a massive yawn.
Lord Parker?
Gasped Robin.
That's the one, said Strike.
He's been...
Shagging three women simultaneously and salting millions away offshore, said Strike. If you've got a strong stomach, try the News of the World this Sunday.
How on earth did you find all that out?
Contact of a contact of a contact, intoned Strike.
He yawned again, so widely that it looked painful.
You should go to bed, said Robin.
Yes, I should, said Strike,
but he did not move.
You haven't got anyone else till Gunfrey this afternoon at 2.
Gunfrey, sighed Strike, massaging his eye sockets. Why are all my clients shit?
Mrs. Quine doesn't seem like a shit.
He peered blearily at her through his thick fingers.
How do you know I took her case?
I knew you would, said Robin with an irrepressible smirk. She's your type.
A middle-aged throwback to the '80s.
Your kind of client.
And you wanted to spite Baker.
Seemed to work, didn't it?
The telephone rang. Still grinning, Robin answered.
Cormor and Strike's office, she said. Oh, hi.
It was her fiancé, Matthew. She glanced sideways at her boss. Strike had closed his eyes and tilted his head back, his arms folded across his broad chest.
Listen, said Matthew in Robin's ear.
He never sounded very friendly when calling from work. I need to move drinks from Friday to Thursday.
Oh, Matt,
she said, trying to keep both disappointment and exasperation out of her voice. It would be the fifth time that arrangements for these particular drinks had been made. Robin alone, of the three people involved, had not altered time, date, or venue, but had shown herself willing and available on every occasion.
Why?
She muttered. A sudden grunting snore issued from the sofa. Strike had fallen asleep where he sat, his large head tilted back against the wall, arms still folded.
Work drinks on the 19th, said Matthew. It'll look bad if I don't go. Show my face.
She fought the urge to snap at him. He worked for a major firm of accountants, and sometimes he acted as though this imposed social obligations more appropriate to a diplomatic posting. She was sure that she knew the real reason for the change. Drinks had been postponed repeatedly at Strike's request. On each occasion he had been busy with some piece of urgent evening work, and while the excuses had been genuine, they had irritated Matthew. Though he had never said it aloud, Robin knew that Matthew thought Strike was implying that his time was more valuable than Matthew's, his job more important. In the 8 months that she had worked for Cormoran Strike, her boss and her fiancé had not met, not even on that infamous night when Matthew had picked her up from the casualty department where she had accompanied Strike, with her coat wrapped tightly around his stabbed arm after a cornered killer had tried to finish him. When she had emerged, shaken and bloodstained, from the place where they were stitching Strike up, Matthew had declined her offer to introduce him to her injured boss. He had been furious about the whole business, even though Robin had assured him that she herself had never been in any danger. Matthew had never wanted her to take a permanent job with Strike, whom he had regarded with suspicion from the first, disliking his penury, his homelessness, and the profession that Matthew seemed to find absurd. The little snatches of information that Robin brought home, Strike's career in the Special Investigation Branch, the plainclothes wing of the Royal Military Police, his decorations for bravery, the loss of his lower right leg, the expertise in 100 areas of which Matthew, so used to being expert in her eyes, knew little or nothing, had not, as she had innocently hoped, built a bridge between the two men, but had somehow reinforced the wall between them. Strike's burst of fame, his sudden shift from failure to success, had, if anything, deepened Matthew's animosity. Robin realized belatedly that she had only exacerbated matters by pointing out Matthew's inconsistencies. "You don't like him being homeless and poor, and now you don't like him getting famous and bringing in loads of work." But Strike's worst crime in Matthew's eyes, as she well knew, was the clinging designer dress that her boss had bought her after their trip to the hospital, the one that he had intended as a gift of gratitude and farewell, and which, after showing it to Matthew with pride and delight, and seeing his reaction, she had never dared wear. All of this Robin hoped to fix with a face-to-face meeting, but repeated cancellations by Strike had merely deepened Matthew's dislike. On the last occasion, Strike had simply failed to turn up. His excuse, that he had been forced to take a detour to shake off a tale set on him by his client's suspicious spouse, had been accepted by Robin, who knew the intricacies of that particularly bloody divorce case, but it had reinforced Matthew's view of Strike as attention-seeking and arrogant. She had had some difficulty in persuading Matthew to commit to a fourth attempt at drinks. Time and venue had both been picked by Matthew, but now, after Robin had secured Strike's agreement all over again, Matthew was changing the night, and it was impossible not to feel that he was doing it to make a point, to show Strike that he too had other commitments, that he too, Robin could not help herself thinking it, could piss people around. "Fine," she sighed into the phone. "I'll check with Cormoran and see whether Thursday's okay."
"You don't sound like it's fine."
"Matt, don't start. I'll ask him, okay?"
"I'll see you later then."
Robin replaced the receiver. Strike was now in full throat, snoring like a traction engine with his mouth open, legs wide apart, feet flat on the floor, arms folded. She sighed, looking at her sleeping boss. Strike had never shown any animosity towards Matthew, had never passed comment on him in any way. It was Matthew who brooded over the existence of Strike, who rarely lost an opportunity to point out that Robin could have earned a great deal more if she had taken any of the other jobs she had been offered before deciding to stay with a rackety private detective, deep in debt and unable to pay her what she deserved. It would ease her home life considerably if Matthew could be brought to share her opinion of Cormoran Strike, to like him, even admire him. Robin was optimistic. She liked both of them, so why could they not like each other? With a sudden snort, Strike was awake. He opened his eyes and blinked at her.
"I was snoring," he stated, wiping his mouth.
"Not much," she lied. "Listen, Cormoran, would it be all right if we move drinks from Friday to Thursday?"
"Drinks?"
"With Matthew and me," she said. "Remember? The King's Arms, Rupel Street." "I did write it down for you," she said, with a slightly forced cheeriness.
"Right," he said. "Yeah. Friday."
"No, Matt wants... he can't do Friday. Is it okay to do Thursday instead?"
"Yeah, fine," he said groggily. "I think I'm going to try and get some sleep, Robin."
"All right,"
I'll make a note about Thursday.
What's happening on Thursday?
Drinks with... Oh, never mind, go and sleep.
She sat staring blankly at her computer screen after the glass door had closed, then jumped as it opened again.
Robin, could you call a bloke called Christian Fisher? Said Strike. Tell him who I am, tell him I'm looking for Owen Quine, and that I need the address of the writer's retreat he told Quine about.
Christian Fisher. Where does he work?
Bugger, muttered Strike. I never asked. I'm so knackered. He's a publisher, a trendy publisher.
No problem, I'll find him. Go and sleep.
When the glass door had closed a second time, Robin turned her attention to Google. Within 30 seconds, she had discovered that Christian Fisher was the founder of a small press called Crossfire, based in Exmouth Market. As she dialed the publisher's number, she thought of the wedding invitation that had been sitting in her handbag for a week now. Robin had not told Strike the date of her and Matthew's wedding, nor had she told Matthew that she wished to invite her boss. If Thursday's drinks went well...
Crossfire!
Said a shrill voice on the line. Robin focused her attention on the job in hand. Chapter 5. There's nothing of so infinite vexation as man's own thoughts. John Webster, The White Devil. 9:20 that evening found Strike lying in a t-shirt and boxers on top of his duvet, with the remnants of a takeaway curry on the chair beside him, reading the sports pages while the news played on the TV he had set up facing the bed. The metal rod that served as his right ankle gleamed silver in the light from the cheap desk lamp he had placed on a box beside him. There was to be an England-France friendly at Wembley on Wednesday night, but Strike was much more interested in Arsenal's home derby against Spurs the following Saturday. He had been an Arsenal fan since his earliest youth, in imitation of his Uncle Ted. Why Uncle Ted supported the Gunners when he had lived all his life in Cornwall was a question Strike had never asked. A misty radiance, through which stars were struggling to twinkle, filled the night sky beyond the tiny window beside him. A few hours' sleep in the middle of the day had done virtually nothing to alleviate his exhaustion, but he did not feel quite ready to turn in yet. Not after a large lamb biryani and a pint of beer. A note in Robin's handwriting lay beside him on the bed. She had given it to him as he had left the office that evening. Two appointments were noted there. The first read, Christian Fisher, 9 a.m. tomorrow, Crossfire Publishing, Exmouth Market, EC1.
Why does he want to see me? Strike had asked her, surprised. I only need the address of that retreat he told Quine about.
I know, said Robin. That's what I told him. But he sounded really excited to meet you. He said he could do 9 tomorrow and wouldn't take no for an answer.
What? Strike asked himself irritably, staring at the note. Was I playing at?
Exhausted, he had allowed temper to get the better of him that morning and ditched a well-heeled client who might well have put more work his way. Then he had allowed Leonora Quine to steamroller him into accepting her as a client on the most dubious promise of payment. Now that she was not in front of him, it was hard to remember the mixture of pity and curiosity that had made him take her case on. In the stark, cold quiet of his attic room, his agreement to find her sulking husband seemed quixotic and irresponsible. Wasn't the whole point of trying to pay off his debts that he could regain a sliver of free time? A Saturday afternoon at the Emirates, a Sunday lie-in. He was finally making money after working almost non-stop for months, attracting clients not only because of that first glaring bout of notoriety, but because of a quieter word of mouth. Couldn't he have put up with William Baker for another 3 weeks? And what, Strike asked himself, looking down at Robin's handwritten note again, was this Christian Fisher so excited about that he wanted to meet in person? Could it be Strike himself, either as the solver of the Lula Landry case or, much worse, as the son of Johnny Rokeby? It was very difficult to gauge the level of your own celebrity. Strike had assumed that his burst of unexpected fame was on the wane. It had been intense while it lasted, but the telephone calls from journalists had subsided months ago, and it was almost as long since he had given his name in any neutral context and heard Lula Landry's back. Strangers were once again doing what they had done most of his life, calling him some variation on Cameron Strick. On the other hand, perhaps the publisher knew something about the vanished Owen Quine that he was eager to impart to Strike, although why, in this case, he had refused to tell Quine's wife, Strike could not imagine. The second appointment that Robin had written out for him was beneath Fisher's. Thursday, November the 18th, 6:30 p.m., The King's Arms, 25 Rupel Street, SE1. Strike knew why she had written the date out so clearly. She was determined that this time, was it the third or fourth time they tried, he and her fiancé would finally meet. Little though the unknown accountant might believe it, Strike was grateful for Matthew's mere existence, and for the sapphire and diamond ring that shone from Robin's third finger. Matthew sounded like a dickhead. Robin little imagined how accurately Strike remembered each of her casual asides about her fiancé, but he imposed a useful barrier between Strike and a girl who might otherwise disturb his equilibrium. Strike had not been able to guard against warm feelings for Robin, who had stuck by him when he was at his lowest ebb and helped him turn his fortunes around, nor, having normal eyesight, could he escape the fact that she was a very good-looking woman. He viewed her engagement as the means by which a thin, persistent draught is blocked up, something that might, if allowed to flow untrammeled, start to seriously disturb his comfort. Strike considered himself to be in recovery after a long, turbulent relationship that had ended, as indeed it had begun, in lies. He had no wish to alter his single status, which he found comfortable and convenient, and had successfully avoided any further emotional entanglements for months, in spite of his sister Lucy's attempts to fix him up with women who sounded like the desperate dregs of some dating site. Of course, it was possible that once Matthew and Robin were actually married, Matthew might use his improved status to persuade his new wife to leave the job that he clearly disliked her doing. Strike had correctly interpreted Robin's hesitations and evasions on that score. However, Strike was sure that Robin would have told him had the wedding date been fixed, so he considered that danger, at present, remote. With yet another huge yawn, he folded the newspaper and threw it onto the chair, turning his attention to the television news. His one personal extravagance since moving into the tiny attic flat had been satellite TV. His small portable set now sat on top of a skybox, and the picture, no longer reliant on a feeble indoor aerial, was sharp instead of grainy. Kenneth Clark, the Justice Secretary, was announcing plans to slash £350 million from the legal aid budget. Strike watched through his haze of tiredness as the florid, paunchy man told Parliament that he wished to discourage people from resorting to lawyers whenever they face a problem, and instead encourage them to consider more suitable methods of dispute resolution. He meant, of course, that poor people ought to relinquish the services of the law. The likes of Strike's average client would still avail themselves of expensive barristers. Most of his work these days was undertaken on behalf of the mistrustful, endlessly betrayed rich. His was the information that fed their sleek lawyers, that enabled them to win better settlements in their vitriolic divorces and their acrimonious business disputes. A steady stream of well-heeled clients was passing his name onto similar men and women, with tediously similar difficulties. This was the reward for distinction in his particular line of work, and if it was often repetitive, it was also lucrative. When the news ended, he clambered laboriously off the bed, removed the remnants of his meal from the chair beside him, and walked stiffly into his small kitchen area to wash everything up. He never neglected such things. Habits of self-respect learned in the army had not left him in the depths of his poverty, nor were they entirely due to military training. He had been a tidy boy, imitating his Uncle Ted, whose liking for order everywhere from his toolbox to his boathouse had contrasted so starkly with the chaos that had surrounded Strike's mother, Leda. Within 10 minutes, after a last pee in the toilet that was always sodden because of its proximity to the shower, and cleaning his teeth at the kitchen sink where there was more room, Strike was back on his bed, removing his prosthesis. The weather forecast for the next day was rounding off the news. Sub-zero temperatures and fog. Strike rubbed powder into the end of his amputated leg. It was less sore tonight than it had been a few months ago. Today's full English breakfast and takeaway curry notwithstanding, he had lost a bit of weight since he had been able to cook for himself again, and this had eased the pressure on his leg. He pointed the remote control at the TV screen. A laughing blonde and her washing powder vanished into blankness. Strike manoeuvred himself clumsily beneath the covers. Of course, if Owen Quine was hiding at his writer's retreat, it would be easy enough to winkle him out. Egotistical bastard, he sounded, flouncing off into the darkness with his precious book. The hazy mental image of a furious man storming away with a holdall over his shoulder dissolved almost as quickly as it had formed. Strike was sliding into a welcome, deep, and dreamless sleep. The faint pulse of a bass guitar far below in the subterranean bar was swiftly drowned by his own rasping snores. Chapter 6. Oh, Mr. Tattle, everything is safe with you, we know. William Congreve, Love for Love. Wads of icy mist were still clinging to the buildings of Exmouth Market when Strike turned into it at 8:50 the following morning. It did not feel like a London street, not with pavement seating outside its many cafes, pastel-painted facades, and a basilica-like church, gold, blue, and brick. Church of Our Most Holy Redeemer, wreathed in smoky vapour. Chilly fog, shops full of curios, curbside tables and chairs. If he could have added the tang of salt water and the mournful screech of seagulls, he might have thought himself back in Cornwall, where he had spent the most stable parts of his childhood. A small sign on a nondescript door beside a bakery announced the offices of Crossfire Publishing. Strike buzzed the bell promptly at 9 o'clock, and was admitted to a steep whitewashed staircase, up which he clambered with some difficulty and with liberal use of the handrail. He was met on the top landing by a slight, dandyish and bespectacled man of around 30. He had wavy shoulder-length hair and wore jeans, a waistcoat, and a paisley shirt with a touch of frill around the cuffs. "Hi there," he said. "I'm Christian Fisher. Cameron, isn't it?"
"Cormoran," Strike corrected him automatically. But he had been about to say that he answered to Cameron, a stock response to years of the mistake, but Christian Fisher came back at once.
"Cormoran, Cornish giant."
"That's right," said Strike, surprised.
"We published a kid's book on English folklore last year," said Fisher, pushing open white double doors and leading Strike into a cluttered open-plan space with walls plastered in posters and many untidy bookshelves. A scruffy young woman with dark hair looked up curiously at Strike as he walked past.
"Coffee? Tea?"
offered Fisher, leading Strike into his own office, a small room off the main area with a pleasant view over the sleepy, foggy street. "I can get Jay to nip out for us." Strike declined, saying truthfully that he had just had coffee, but wondering, too, why Fisher seemed to be settling in for a longer meeting than Strike felt the circumstances justified.
"Just a latte, then, Jade,"
Fisher called through the door.
"Have a seat,"
Fisher said to Strike, and he began to flit around the bookshelves that lined the walls.
"Didn't he live in St. Michael's Mount, the giant cormoran?"
"Yeah," said Strike. "And Jack's supposed to have killed him, of beanstalk fame."
"It's here somewhere," said Fisher, still searching the shelves. "Folk Tales of the British Isles. Have you got kids?"
"No," said Strike.
"Oh," said Fisher. "Well, I won't bother then."
And with a grin, he took the chair opposite Strike.
"So, am I allowed to ask who's hired you? Am I allowed to guess?"
"Feel free," said Strike, who on principle never forbade speculation.
It's either Daniel Chard or Michael Fancourt, said Fisher.